So I'm going to talk about post-quantum cryptography. And when I was making the slides, I was thinking, okay, I still have to motivate this area because, well, it's still a bit niche, but it's absolutely great to see that we have a three-session post-quantum crypto here. And then I come here, and what I find in my bag is post-quantum for dummies. So I guess you all know what post-quantum cryptography is. Let me still run a little bit through the history. So this term post-quantum cryptography comes from 2003, when Dan Bernstein, who is also somewhere in the audience, back there, Dan. So it was clear already that we need some alternative cryptography. We need something that resists quantum computers. But it's not really good if you're trying to apply for money or trying to explain to some fellow cryptographer what you're working on, if you have to tell the whole story and there's no nice words. So Dan came up with the short-term post-quantum cryptography as a term to say it's cryptography where we assume the attacker has a quantum computer. So it's something about the attack model. So in the post-quantum world, our attacker has a quantum computer, our user might have a quantum computer, but honestly, there will be a long time till we have a quantum computer, while some attackers, be it governments, be it the mafia, be it other entities, have a quantum computer and can use this to decrypt. And then we've been trying to motivate people to work on this because it's an important topic. So this is now 15 years ago, and we've been running around saying, hey, guys, the end is nigh, do something. And then whenever you're the idiot who's going like, the end is nigh, everybody goes like, yeah, crazy. Still, we put together a conference 2006. That was the first Pika Crypto conference. It was a smallish group of people, I think fewer people than we have in the audience today, I would say like 40-something, interested researchers who had been working on topics of building crypto systems and analyzing them, and we're the lucky winners of having crypto systems that are not broken by quantum computers. And we have come a long way from there. So back 2006, it was this small niche area. Then we started having conferences, proceedings to motivate people because, well, you want to have a line on your CV to get a paper. And then 2014, I would say, I would put the first check mark. That was the conference on post-quantum crypto in Waterloo run by Mike Musker and Alfred Mendes. And that was the first time we saw more than 100 participants. Mind you, these are narrow topic people who built systems, who are doing the math and doing the algorithm. It's not like this conference. We have lots of people who go with industry and applications and standardization about it. But these are really the people who sit down and build the systems that you will later on see as something to certify. And then, well, the EU finally woke up. There's been a call. We got some project funded. So down there is our mascot, the tortoise. Because that was kind of indicative of what post-quantum cryptography was back in 2014. We know how to build very strong, very resistant systems that have a long life, like a tortoise. But they're also a little bit clunky. I mean, if you don't recognize it, this is a Galapagos tortoise. These are like big things that don't fit through your internet packets. They can move, but they're not really known for high speed. So that's how we started with our project. And then over the next few years, so NIST has been leading the field in having a call for post-quantum cryptography, and Lil Chen is going to say a lot more about it later. I'm going to say a little bit about it. And so this year, the post-quantum crypto conference, just 12 years later, had grown to 350 people, and it was only 350 people because the room didn't fit more than 350. So it's now a big thing. We had lots of people from industry. We had lots of people from building systems, not the people who just make algorithms, but people who put these on smart cards, people who put them on FPGAs, and of course also people who put them in internet protocols and so on. So it's going into a much, much bigger field. And as we see here, we have a three-session conference or track on post-quantum. All right. Now, that's actually where it all began. So there was Shor's paper from 94, published a few years later, saying, hey, guys, there is something cool about this quantum computing model. Now, he says cool because he's doing quantum algorithms. I, as a cryptographer, goes like, wow, scary. Now, when I say we're going to have something more scary than Pacific Rim or other monsters, it's this paper. This paper is what keeps me up at night. This paper is what gives me nightmares. And this paper is what might give you nightmares, depending on what you're out to protect. The effects from Shor's paper, well, okay, you need a quantum computer. This is not a quantum computer, but quantum computers are coming. So Mike Musker is going to give a much more detailed overview than I can possibly give here. But if you're just staying for the first talk, let me give you a short rundown. So quantum computing is, or building quantum computers, is now something that big companies are investing in. So I put here Google, IBM, Intel, Microsoft. I hear there are some others. I don't know how much Mike will talk about that. Getting some notes here, there's going to be an update on this. And so they're investing big research money in building those. Now, of course, you're seeing announcement of 9 qubits, 50 qubits. And then you hear somebody else talking about how many you need to build to run Shor's algorithms, and you're somewhere in the millions. So you're like, all right, I can go back to sleep. But the thing is, those announcements are not really the thing to track. The thing to track is how stable are those, how long can they last, and how well are they interconnected. And what we're seeing there is gigantic progress, really taking up speed very recently. So it's something where, yes, they're small now, but they can grow pretty quickly. Now, in 2012, Mike Ketchum from IBM had to apparently give some statements about like how long it's going to take. And what's interesting was it was the first time that somebody was actually willing to put a date on it. It used to be something, yeah, well, we are believing that we can build those, but, well, not for the next 5 to 10 years. And he actually said it's something that it's going to be 10 to 15 years. Now, fast forwarding from 2012 till, well, 10 to 15 years later, what are the impacts of this? So the impact of having a large quantum computer that can run Shor's algorithm is that all the crypto that we currently see when you click on the log in your browser, you're checking what your connection is secured with, then you're going to see ECC, you're going to see RSA, you're going to see Fine-Field Diffie-Hellman. And those are exactly the systems that are massively affected by Shor's algorithm. For those, we currently don't have anything but runs in polynomial time. ECC, we believe, runs in exponential time. We don't have anything sub-exponential. For the other two, fine-field discrete log and RSA, we have sub-exponential algorithms, but we have a good control over how they work. We do believe that RSA with 4,000 bits is going to be good till eternity. Well, eternity or until a quantum computer gets built. So once a quantum computer is there, it doesn't run in 2 to the something of the size. It just runs in something of the size. It's a polynomial in the number of bits you're seeing. And that for most of these systems means it takes you about as long to run them as it takes the attacker to break them. There are some differences in scale because a quantum computer probably won't be as fast. It's more like the IBM computers of the 60s. Your clock cycle is going to be much slower. You're going to have smaller RAM and so on. But that's just a matter of technology development. Having the Shor's algorithms there, which says this is how things scale. You're trying to run away from the attacker. You double your key size. Well, you just make it twice as hard for the attacker. That's not much. So at the moment, we're in the luxury situation where you double your key size and you make it exponentially much harder for the attacker. In the future of the quantum computer, not so much. Now, you have seen a lot more crypto than just those three. How about the other ones? How about, say, AES or hash functions and so on? So there, the situation is not quite as bad. Shor's algorithm doesn't apply. There's another algorithm which is both cooler and less cool. So it's due to Grover, and the part where it's more cool is that it's more universally applicable. So it's an algorithm that works on anything where you're trying to find a pre-image. Say you have a ciphertext, and you have the plain text, but you don't know what key it was. Searching for this thing at the moment would take you about 2 to the length of the key. So if you have AES-128, it takes you 2 to the 128 operations. With Grover's attack, it takes you 2 to the 64 operations. Now, that's the good news. It is still exponential. The thing up there, 64, is still pretty damn large. Also, we can just double the key size, go for AES-256, which we have sitting around anyway, and then we're back to the 2 to the 128. And that's going to be 2 to the 128 quantum operations, where we don't actually ever expect to get there. So Grover's attack, while it's more universally applicable, it's also much easier to control. You make your keys larger, and you run away from it. So we don't have this problem as we have with Shor, that there's basically no real way of escape. Now, why are we talking about this now? Why in 2003 did Dan run around saying, hey, the end is nigh, we need to do something? Or why did we try to get the crypto audience to be looking into it? One problem is, if you're handling any data that is relevant, not just for the next 5 minutes or next 5 days, but for many, many years, And it really depends on your attack scenario and your protection scenario and risk management whether you have any such things. So one typical example is health data where there's a legal requirement to keep it confidential for 30 years. Health data is also something which will go over the internet. If I go to a doctor, the doctor does something with me, then the next thing is he sends something to the billing company. And then the billing company sends something to my insurance company. Now, each of those times, it gets encrypted with whatever the internet has to offer, which is typically ECC or RSA, which is going to be broken with a quantum computer. Now, if anybody is interested in my health data 30 years from now, 20 years from now, when they have a quantum computer, they can actually take today's transcript. They just take whatever went over the internet today, use it with their quantum computer, and break it. Now, I think my health data is not that interesting, but if you have more interesting applications, for instance, there are lots of companies that instead of making patents, they have secret designs. Favorite example is the recipe of Coca-Cola. For a patent, it would have long expired. For a patent, it would have gotten somebody to buy it. But since it's a secret recipe, if they ever send it from the factory in Atlanta to their branch over here in Canada, then they're sending some secret information and, well, maybe Pepsi is proud of their own things, but what is the cheap company here? Aldi Cola would be the European version. They're certainly eager to get this recipe. So they wait, they tap the line, or they have their favorite government institution do the industrial espionage, and then just wait till the quantum computer is there, and suddenly they have the secret recipe. So if you have anything that needs to be protected for a long time, you're actually late by now. Because if the estimates are correct that it's 10, 15 years, or I'll make it a little bit less advertisement speed, make it 20 to 30 years, and your target of keeping something confidential is longer than that, you have a problem. You have a problem today, but you will only notice that you had a problem today in 20 years. So it's a very strange thing. It's a little bit like time travel. Because all our connection data starts with the public key part. And I used to give these talks before 2013 was like, well, assume there's somebody listening. Yeah, Tanya's wearing her tinfoil hat again. Well, 2013 came and we had Snowden, and now I can just say, well, there is somebody listening. There are lots of stations worldwide that listen to you. We only know these for the US, but I would be very surprised if other governments wouldn't have similar programs. They will have the dots in different positions, but there will be similar dots where they're trying to get to the internet exchanges, where they're tapping underwater cables and so on. So you can assume that everything which goes over the internet is in the hands of the attacker. Worse, if you're doing cloud storage, you're actually storing your data on the computers of your attacker. So you have to assume that everything which you ever send over the public internet or send to a cloud storage is known to, well, whatever entity with interesting thoughts here. And if this entity is powerful enough, rich enough, that it might have a quantum computer at some time, then those will use the quantum computer and get your secrets from today. So that's the story for encryption. I used to say that, well, with signatures matter the moment you check your, say, system update. Like we saw in the last talk, Microsoft updates are very important, and your computer sits there and verifies that you're actually getting a valid certificate or valid update, so there's a signature on it. And I used to say, well, look, guys, that matters the moment you execute it. Even if you're signing your last will electronically, once there is the news of a quantum computer, you just go to the notary, pull out your new signature key, and then you sign again. But then there won't be a news item saying the Chinese have a quantum computer in the basement. There won't be a news item that the NSA has a quantum computer in their basement. Maybe 5 years later, when the university groups have gotten far enough or the company groups have gotten far enough, there will be an announcement. But that's 5 years later. There have been 5 years in the meantime where all of your updates have not been secured. So if your main function of a signature is to actually protect system updates, then you should think about rolling out a signature system now. It's pretty cheap, in particular for code updates. You don't use it so often. You can even use something we call stateful hash-based signatures. And then you have something in place which just works, which just protects you against quantum computer, and then it doesn't matter that you're not getting the memo that a quantum computer is there because you're already preemptively protected against it. So I've been talking with some people from the banking industry who say, well, we put these card readers out in the field, and we don't expect them to see them back in 30 years. Yeah, we're putting some updates on there, so there should be signatures, but we actually know that we can't reach them. And so they were saying, yeah, well, this is probably their scenario. So if you're in that industry, or if you're thinking about car manufacturers, Continental, they put little chips and tires, they also don't get those tires back in due time. So anything where you're putting something out where you don't expect to get it back quickly, consider putting a signature on it, at least if it lasts a long time. I don't think the Continental tire lasts 15 years, but the cars will hopefully last longer. All right, so what can we do? So I mentioned already our Poco Crypto project, so that's the tortoise thing there. And so what we got, what we started at the beginning was, let's get together and figure out what we as at least the European leading experts in the field have to say. What can we recommend to people who say, well, I have to do something now? I understood the advertisement, I have data that has to be secure, has to be confidential, or I have an issue with system updates which I would like to deal with. What can we do? So our motivation at that point was to give long-term secure. Really something super, super conservative, super boring, very much the tortoise picture. So we do not care about speed, we do not care about size, we do care about long-term security. And so this was what we were recommending in 2015, and we're still recommending those. But since this is a progress on post-quantum, I will also tell a bit more of what happened in the meantime. Just to run through the picture, so the first category is symmetric cryptography, where I said, don't worry too much. Yes, we have Grover's algorithm, but Shor doesn't apply. So make sure to use a 256-bit key, and you'll be fine. Well, use a 256-bit key and a system that is well understood. What we put in there back then was AES256, which is the default. We put in Salsa. Meanwhile, Google has been pushing for ChaCha, pretty much the same security assumption. So if you have either of those with a 256-bit key, you're good to go. Then you need a symmetric authentication. You need something where on each packet you're not only having encryption on it, but also some validity check that this packet hasn't been modified, that it comes from the right person who has the same secret key. So we have the symmetric authentication part. So Max, you probably have seen GCMs running around. And GCM is going to be fine as well. It's actually an area where we have no application of Grover and no application of Shor. So with Max, we're definitely good to go. And then comes the part where we really see Shor. So public key encryption, public key signatures. And there our recommendations were to use code-based cryptography, and I'm going to have some more slides on that, and hash-based signatures. Those were the ones where we said, okay, we're sufficiently confident these have been holding up for a long time, or we understand the security assumptions so well that if anybody now needs security for the next 100 years, we feel confident that these are going to hold up. And then we had a lot more to look at. Quick comment on the public key signatures. So normally a signature, you have a secret key, and you're producing signatures. Okay, why am I telling this? The thing is, in hash-based signatures, there is a different scenario to consider, namely what we call stateful signatures. You have a secret key, you have a counter, how many signatures you've made, and you're producing signatures. So if you're in a system, for instance, you're doing code signing, where you know who signs how many packets when, you can actually afford having such a counter. If you're on a smart card where you have tamper-proof devices anyway, where you have a counter which you can update, you can't use those. If you're on a virtual machine where you reboot and you reset your counter, you can't use those. So XMSS, which is the first of these signatures there, that's what's currently being standardized by the ITF. That is a stateful system. So that is not a full-fledged replacement of a signature scheme, but it is a very fast, very small signature scheme. And it has very good security assumptions. And then we had a proposal, Sphinx, which is taking away the problem with the state. So there you can use, you have a secret key and you're producing signatures, no need for counters. But it is somewhat bigger, it's somewhat slower. Now, I promised some quick run through other stuff. So NIST, Lily Chen, is going to talk a lot more about this. So they said we're going to run a competition. Let's see what submits. So the deadline was in December, 30th of November. And then Dusty Moody, who is also in the audience, gave a presentation at the AsiaCrypt conference and gave a short classification of what systems have been submitted. And here we see the main categories of post-quantum crypto. So I mentioned already code-based for encryption. You can also do signatures. CEM means key encapsulation. That's basically encryption. And then hash-based, I mentioned with the signatures. But there are also other systems, lattices, isogenies, which you're going to see lots of talks about here. They're currently under other here. And then multivariate crypto. Now, what are you going to do over Christmas? So finally, on the 21st of December, we got a Christmas present from NIST, and all these submissions were posted online. And then one of my students, who had nothing better to do, in the next 3 hours broke the first system, and then the same evening we broke another system. Now, that shouldn't tell you that all post-quantum crypto is broken. It just means that this competition was getting everybody who was interested in this to submit something. And some of those had more formal training than others. So the picture now is more like this. Red means there is an efficient script that actually breaks it. This orange, brownish color, whatever comes out here, is there are some scratches. So for instance, it doesn't have CCA security or something like that. So, or they need bigger parameters. Plastic McLeese is one of our entries. That is basically what we proposed back in the 2015 recommendations. And here you see who's standing behind the system. The bad news, yes, we have big keys. So that is still some reminiscence of the turtle, the tortoise. It is big. It is 1 megabyte keys. Now, these are 1 megabyte keys for the highest security level that NIST has, and I hear it's called ridiculous level of security or something like this in official terms. So this is so large that we don't expect to ever see a quantum computer that breaks us. This is like 2 to the 128 when you take the square root, so 2 to the 256 pre-quantum. It's really, really large. And we have two parameter sets depending on some small trade-offs, but both of them are pretty big. Our current software is not particularly fast. What we did is, if anybody wants to use this, it's safe to use the software. It is constant time. You can just run it, and it's free to use. There has been some optimizations in hardware, so there's a very fast FPGA implementation split over two papers. That tells you a little bit more about what speed you could actually get. And this is speed for key generation. Now, if you have a key which is good for the next 100 years, you might not want to do a new key for each packet. So this scenario is more like the PGP scenario where you do one good key and you keep it. And then it also doesn't hurt you so much if it's a megabyte because you can just give it to the party and then you can start communicating. More positive news is we have actually very short ciphertexts. Something around 200 bytes. That is not as nice as elliptic curves, but it's not so much worse than what we're currently dealing with RSA. So when you look at ciphertext size, that is pretty neat, and the speeds there, again, this can do much faster, but we made it constant time, so it's safe to use. So some couple of 100,000 cycles. Again, very fast in hardware. And if you say, oh, 240 bytes, well, you're just a little bit too large. Can you give me something smaller? There is still some room for trade-offs. You can make the public key a bit larger and get ciphertext a bit smaller. We figured this was a good trade-off, but there are other possibilities if you really say, hey, my network can handle only this size. But in general, 200 bytes is pretty much at the low end for the post-quantum sizes. The security assumption, so there's a one-way operations. It's basically, it's a binary matrix, so it's just zeros and ones. It's more wide than it's tall, and you're taking a long vector of zeros and ones, many more zeros than ones, and you're telling me what is this thing times the matrix. That's your ciphertext. And then there have been some research on this even before code-based crypto came out, because this is a basic coding theory question. So coding theory is in error-correcting codes. And so in the 60s, Prange came up with what's called now Prange's algorithm. And McLeese, when he proposed the system in 1978, used Prange's algorithm to kind of estimate parameter sizes. So if you look at something which has 2 to the lambda security, then this tells you, OK, it's exponential security, exponential in the size. And the main parameters is C0, the 0.74 blah, 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 something. Remember this number, OK? It's going to be on the test. So that was the state, well, late 70s, and actually for an algorithm going back to the 60s. But 40 years later, There have been more than 30 tech papers. Some of them consider a model with a quantum computer. Most of them don't because, well, in 62, this was not really the question you were answering. And so with all of these papers, where are we now? Well, if you want to have a key which gives you 2 to the lambda security, then that is how large the key is. And the main parameter is C0, which is 0.74188, and you should remember this number. So within 40 years, there have been no improvements on the keys, on the security. There have not been any improvements on the main part of the attack. There's a little bit less in the little O of 1, but in the main part, this has been extremely well holding up. Now, we're talking about post-quantum. If you're worried about quantum attacks, and that's why you're in the session, then you replace lambda by 2 lambda, and you're definitely good to go. So that is assuming that Grover works full-fledged and nothing happens. So that is the best we can possibly see a quantum computer doing. So the classic Michaelis system, which is our submission NIST, is using all of those pieces, using some improvements. I mean, it's not that only the attacks have been improving over the last 40 years. There have been algorithmic improvements, and we're including all of those in there, but we still have a direct link to the well-studied security assumption of this, what's called syndrome decoding. Here are parameters for it. Not going to run through the parameters, A, out of time, B, not very interesting, but we are stable enough about this to say, hey, with these parameters, we do believe it's 3 to the 256 pre-quantum and at best, at least to the 128 post-quantum. You don't just want something which is secure, you also want something which is secure in real-life attacks, so somebody could send you a malfunctioning packet or something, so we need what's called CCA security, so somebody sends you an active attack and looks how you're acting, and there we also have a very boring conversion. Including this boring conversion, it does blow up your ciphertext size, but including that, we're still at the 200 bytes. So we do not actually use it for encryption. We use this for generating a symmetric key and then use symmetric crypto, say AS256 or CHA20 with 256-bit key after that. So this E, which I had before, this vector, which had lots of zeros and a few ones, we run this through a hash function. That's our symmetric key. We have a key confirmation in there so that nobody can modify a piece of the ciphertext. So I also send another, a different hash function, say, append 1, run through SHA-256, and then that's the confirmation which I also sent along. So I'm proving to the receiver that I actually know the E. And then the receiver verifies all these pieces, so there is no way anybody could have modified it, so what is known as reaction attacks don't apply. There's no failure cases, so there's lots of little things built in to make this a nice system, so this is more fleshed out than what we had in the 2015 proposal, but from the math, from the hardness assumption, it is still very much the same. So the highlights are that it's not changed for 40 years for the asymptotics, very short ciphertext, well, the downside is a big public key. We have constant time implementations. There are no patents on it. And we have lots of open source implementations. One last slide, if I may, as a word of warning. So you shouldn't just think that if you see code-based, it's automatically secure. So what I'm talking about here is code-based using GOBA codes. Actually, one of the first systems that went down in the NIST competition was Rakos, which is based on codes. And we had actually 3 different ways of breaking it. One was that they had a bug in their code, they were confusing bits and bytes and only checking every 8 bits on the signature is not such a good thing. We were able to find pre-image of their specialized hash function, and we even could invert their code-based problem. The 12 broken ones, there are actually several in code-based crypto, so just because something is code-based doesn't mean it's secure. There have been lots of broken ones in the other category, and then some in all of the others. So it's an exciting field. Lots of things are happening. We have some more proposals where we believe they're secure. So if you're interested, they have Swings Plus, which is also with Scott Furrer and Dan Burns in the audience. We have a lattice-based system. So there are systems where I say this is secure, and there are systems where we have fun over Christmas breaking them. With that, I'll show you one last slide with lots of links. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much. We're right up against time. I'm sure Tanya will hang around later for some more questions. But thank you very much.